fighting for America.
The 12-member jury decided not to press charges against Officer Darren Wilson.
Stop assassinating black people!
Town got smashed up. Police guys on fire.
You need to stop throwing objects at the police.
One of the tear gas canisters on the street. Dispersing right now.
Fighting for Idaho.
This is 5 million people being given amnesty that Congress rejected, that the American people have rejected.
Fighting for you.
It's just such a great time of year to really be grateful for what we have and to celebrate what we've accomplished over the year and also to do things for others.
Boise's Mr. Right, Kevin Miller in the Morning, winner of the 2014 Marconi Radio Award on 580 KIDO, Idaho's first radio station.
Kevin Miller in the Morning, 580 KIDO. Joining us now, attorney Effley Bailey, co-author of Excellence in Cross-Examination. Mr. Bailey, it's an honor to have you with us here, sir.
Thank you.
You know, when we talk about the art of the cross-examination, it's always pumped up in movies. It's always pumped up in TV. How realistic is the popular media perception of what really happens in the courtroom?
There have been several movies where it was really well done. Most of them are trash. I mean, they simply break every rule in the book to get dramatic effect. But there are some movies like To Kill a Mockingbird and Anatomy of a Murder where it was done pretty much according to the book. And it's a trick to keep cross-examination interesting because if you're doing it properly, there are spots where it's going to be very dull.
Mr. Bailey, why does everybody want to be a lawyer?
Well, I haven't figured that out because it's not the finest life in the world. It presents a lot of difficulties and cutthroat competition and playing close to the edge of the cliff. I did not recommend any of my sons be lawyers, and if I had to do it over again, I have grave doubts that I would seek that end of the road. However, I must point out that when I wanted to be a lawyer back in the 50s, it was a whole different and, to my mind, much more pleasant ballgame.
Well, a lot of folks may not know that you were a Marine aviator, and once a Marine, always a Marine. Did that help you in the courtroom, sir?
It did, because too many lawyers have been timid at times when they needed to strike boldly forth. And Marines tend to be afraid of very little, if anything. And so if there were an opportunity that took a little bit of chutzpah, I would likely march into the fray. And often I would get my head clobbered, but more often I would wind up with some kind of score. And, you know, you can't tell what's under a rock unless you lift it.
Excellence in Cross-Examination, Effley Bailey with Kevin Miller here at 580KIDO. Can we learn anything from the art of cross-examination and how to deal with people at work or, you know, how to settle disagreements in our own life?
The book was intended to reach a very wide audience, not just lawyers, but witnesses, particularly expert witnesses, people that are thinking of getting into litigation. It will show them the uncertainty of the outcome and also the scarcity of really good trial lawyers out there and some checklists by which to make sure you get one because they're hard to get. On the other hand, if you do have a very good, well-prepared trial lawyer, it immeasurably increases your chances of winning the case. So it's worth doing. That's what the book is all about. It really is a pathway to excellence in cross-examination. Just reading it is not going to make you a good cross-examiner.
What's the biggest misconception about you that you found?
Well, I think it goes with the territory, but the remark I would most often hear from new acquaintances after we'd been together for an hour or so was, kind of, gee, you're really a nice guy. I hadn't expected that. Because the picture is one of a slashing, angry, scowling cross-examiner beating the witness into a pulp as he cowers on the witness stand, and Hollywood has simply helped that image along. The fact is, we very good cross-examiners very rarely get tough with a witness unless he or she richly deserves it and asks for it.
Is that a feeling of comfort that you're trying to establish in the cross, that the witness becomes comfortable, therefore they might not be so guarded and offer something that can help your client?
Yes, that's certainly one technique. One of the phases of cross-examination, I mean, people think it's all about impeachment and attacking witnesses. It is not. One of the early phases in cross-examination is to get from the witness all of the things that he or she knows that is good, are good, about your case that the other side hasn't developed. For instance, you might want to ask a police officer in a criminal case, isn't it true that the defendant won some medals when serving in the Navy 4 years ago? And that's good stuff for a jury to hear. It's not likely the prosecutor will have brought it out, but if it's true, the police officer pretty usually will say yes.
Joining us with F. Lee Bailey, our great friend Alan L. Morton, attorney at law, and Alan always brags about you. He's met you, and he has some specific questions. Alan?
It's good to talk to you again, Lee. It's been said that people don't believe it if they see it. They see it only if they believe it. So if that's the case, how does the role of cross-examination fit into the so-called truth-seeking process of a trial?
Well, there really is a dual responsibility. One is to get at what the witness really knows and may be willing to lie about unless guided forcefully along the road. And the other is to make sure that the jury understands what the witness has said. And this sometimes requires, although I don't like the process, the old adage that teachers rely on. Tell them what you're going to say, then say it, then tell them what you said. And somewhere along the line it will stick. It all depends to a large extent on the intellect of the jury. If you've got a military jury, they've all been to college, they're pretty smart, there's no point in trying to paint a picture three times. But if you've got a rural jury with not many high school educated members on it, you have to go slow and be as graphic and explicit as you can and often be repetitive.
How does one find a good lawyer, sir?
That is the biggest mystery in the world. The first place you look is lawyers, because lawyers know who the good trial lawyers are. One of the tests that I always use when coming into a new community would be to say to someone who was a practitioner, not necessarily a superstar, if you were in really deep trouble, which, if any, of the local members of the bar would you hire and be comfortable with as your chief counsel? And you begin to dredge up names and reputations in that way. For me, the most direct way is to sit and talk with a lawyer. If he's a good trial lawyer, it'll be sticking out all over him, subconsciously perhaps, after 30 minutes.
Of course, that's billable hours.
Well, a lot of trial lawyers don't work for billable hours. Many of them work on a contingent fee in personal injury and wrongful death. Many of them work on a flat fee in criminal cases. If you don't get it up front, you probably never will. And, of course, those working on billable hours have a different motive than those who are not. The longer they can drag a case out, the more billable hours will be brought to the attention of the client.
What other goals do you have or objectives in mind when you cross-examine a witness, Lee? You mentioned impeachment as one of them. What other goals and objectives do you have?
Well, first of all, people must understand that witnesses are trying to emulate a videotape recorder, and that's a tall order. They can't see everything at once, and they can't remember it. So that you've got to explore the process with this witness as to this event, as to how the memory was created. And that begins with perception. What did you hear? That's usually the first introduction to an event, because hearing works over 360 degrees horizontally and vertically. Then what did you see. And by that, you really mean, what did you perceive? You can see 180 degrees from your 90 on either side of your nose. You can only perceive in an arc of 5 to 10 degrees, and people can be talked into thinking they saw things they didn't. Then the question is, why did you remember this? If it was your mother's funeral, of course you would. If it's what you had for breakfast a year ago, that's suspicious unless it's tied to another event. Then how well have you remembered? Every prosecutor in the case, or every plaintiff's lawyer, and every lawyer for every side, and a horde of investigators have all been trying to get you to remember a story favorable to them. How have you been able to resist that? And the last thing that they have to do is to articulate with accuracy the picture in their mind that they carried forward perhaps for several years from the date of the incident that's being litigated. That's phase one. How did you get to be this witness? Then one likes to go into the nice things that one can develop about one's own client, and then, if necessary and not otherwise, the role of impeachment, discrediting the witness, making his story or her story less believable than you think your witnesses will be, because that's how cases are won. They're not won by witnesses breaking down on the witness stand and saying, oh, I lied, woe is me. That's Hollywood stuff.
F. Lee Bailey with us, Kevin Miller, Allen L. Morton, Attorney at Law, 580-KIDO. Now, I love this title, How to Protect Yourself Against Cops in California and Other Strange Places. How do you protect yourself from the cops?
Well, I wrote the book about that. It was for travelers going to other cities and explaining a little bit how the cops operate on OUI. Or if they get mad at you, as this one did at me, they'll dream up an OUI. But there was a lot that was known about driving under the influence, driving while impaired. Various states call it various things and still have different blood alcohol limits that are accepted by their statutes. And so I thought a book might be helpful to explain to people what to do and what not to do if you are going to drive after you've been drinking, hopefully a moderate amount, or if you're going to be accused of drinking even though you haven't been.
More coming up with F. Lee Bailey, Kevin Miller in the Morning, 580-KIDO, our great friend Allen L. Morton, Attorney at Law with us. Excellence in Cross-Examination is Mr. Bailey's new book. We'll talk more about that, and we'll get into some of his more colorful adventures next. Allen L. Morton, Attorney at Law with us. Why? Because we have a very special guest with us, Attorney F. Lee Bailey, author of the new book, Excellence in Cross-Examination. Mr. Bailey, we've got to ask you, and I'm sure you talk about this in the book, O.J. Simpson's victory, and when everybody had the goods on him, he was innocent. How did that happen?
Well, I don't talk in that about the book because I've written a very extensive chapter in that. It's at my website, Bailey and Elliott. People that are really interested in what did happen in the Simpson case, and more importantly, what did not, can read it. It's a very reliable, factual account, and I think the most interesting segment, it describes all the evidence we couldn't put in because we were losing our jury to illnesses, and had we lost the jury, there would have been a mistrial. The prosecution, as a good indicator that they knew they had a crummy case, refused to go along with less than 12 jurors, and had they agreed to go along, we could have gotten down to 6 and still finished the trial. But there are a number of cases, some mine, some done by other lawyers, where the cross-examination is detailed. And by that, I mean hic verba, which is Latin for word for word. And then I make comments in the form of footnotes on what I believe the lawyer was doing. In my case, I know what I was doing, and whether it worked or not. And this is one of the best ways for young lawyers who can't always arrange to get to sit in what we call the second chair in a good trial and learn from a senior colleague. This is the second best way of learning. Study actual cross-examinations. I think there are seven in this book, and we'll add another one every year.
But what about the cross-examination of Furman? Was everything on the line then?
Well, it was. I only had one objective where Furman was concerned. I had a mole in the prosecution who told me they were taking him in the grand jury room at night and trying to train him to say yes when I asked him if he ever used the N-word. And so my job was to get him so worked up that despite this training, he could not say yes. He would lie about it because I knew, and this is before the tapes were discovered, I knew I had plenty of evidence that he used that word viciously and frequently. And so the objective was get Furman to deny that he ever, within 10 years, used the N-word. We couldn't go more than 10 years because 11 years back, he'd signed an affidavit saying how much he hated the N-people and that he needed to be retired on a pension because he was burned out. Judge Ito found that to be too stale, conveniently, and so said you're limited to 10 years, and that's why my questions were directed at the last 10 years. And sure enough, Furman took the bait, said no, he was a cook goose from that point forward.
What was that like working with the Dream Team and the late Johnny Cochran?
Working with Johnny Cochran was great. There was no Dream Team, not by a long shot. There were some good lawyers there. There were some who weren't particularly good. There were too many of them by far. The trial dragged on for 9 months. It was not worth three in most jurisdictions. And I would say that the entire experience, which had its moments, like the acquittal, was generally unpleasant.
Alan L. Morton, you have a question for Mr. Bailey?
How do you prepare for cross-examine, Lee? We consider you in our trade as a virtuoso attorney. We'd like to hear from you as to what you do to prepare.
And certainly they're applicable to people that aren't lawyers as
Absolutely,
well.
Because when you're talking about the business environment, preparing for our conference, maybe even an adversary.
Or a presentation, yeah.
Exactly.
Right. Well, the answer is you do everything under the sun. There is an extensive chapter in the book on preparation because, as Melvin Belli, a famed tort lawyer out in California, once said, if your investigator is good enough, most any lawyer will do. And while that, like a lot of what Mel said, and he was a good friend of mine, was an exaggeration, there is a lot of truth in it because if you've got the facts on your side, you don't have to be handsome or swashbuckling or look like a movie star. You're going to win the case most of the time. So you dig, you look under rocks, you interview everyone you possibly could, sometimes more than once, and try to get the facts down on the one hand that favor your case and try to get enough facts, not on paper, but in your memory, to take apart any witness who could do you substantial damage.
And, of course, if not, just Google a lot and do your own research. So, in other words, be prepared.
Be prepared, and that means it was best put by my mentor when I was young. He was the cock of the walk in criminal law. His name was Edward Bennett Williams. I had lunch with him the day after I took the bar and months before I was admitted, but I tried to quit him a few cases in the military, even though I hadn't been to law school. And I said, Mr. Williams, sometimes you seem to pull a rabbit out of a hat. How do you do that? He said, you come prepared with 50 rabbits and 50 hats, and you get very lucky.
Mr. Bailey, a final thought. We started this interview at 580KIDO when you said that if you had to do it all over again, you wouldn't have been a lawyer. You would have thought about it more than that. But, I mean, you've been successful. You're famous. You've been a part of American history, not only legal history, but American history. Why the regret?
Well, the regrets are several. First of all, I think I was not treated very well by the bar, but I will survive that. And at the end of the day, I'll write about it. and hopefully that's where history will notch the events. But quite a bit beyond that, the practice of law has changed drastically. The public defender was thought to be a great addition to the legal system. It hasn't worked out that way. Public defenders are people that often can't get better jobs elsewhere. They're totally overloaded. They're not well experienced. They don't get the help in the form of investigators and experts and scientific evidence that they need. And I think the telling symbol of that is of the 13 people found to be innocent but sitting on death row in Illinois, all had been represented by a public defender. Almost all were minorities. Their trials had been skimpy, and they were saved from execution only by DNA. So I think a system that's been watered down that bad is not to be admired or chased. If we would go to the British system, where you prosecute one day, defend the next, and trial lawyers are specially certified and recognized, I think we could cure a lot of that. Here in Maine, for instance, there is no public defender system. The judge appoints a lawyer, and usually a competent one, who doesn't get the best of all worlds, but gets more help than public defenders, say, for instance, in New York City.
Boy, that's incredible when you you think about it. The best legal system money can buy, and you take a look at some big major cases. You look at the Duke LaCrosse case. If those guys didn't have competent trial, competent counsel, what would have happened to them?
That's right, and it's a shame because I think capital cases should have their own bar, lawyers that are authorized to try capital cases, simply because mistakes by lawyers are fatal to the client. When they're discovered years later, as often happens through DNA or some other revelation, it's kind of tough to go to the graveside and tell the client, oh boy, we have a new trial order. If only you could attend. So that's a miserable part of the system. I think capital lawyers should be specially chosen from the very top ranks, well paid for what they do, because it would save money in the end and make damn sure that we don't execute innocent people.
Excellence in cross-examination. Mr. Bailey, thank you, sir.
All right. Nice talking with you.
All right. We appreciate that. Before we go, Alan L. Morton, attorney at law, this is one of your heroes. What are your thoughts?
Well, when I was a young man, I read Mr. Lee's book, The Defense Never Rests. It was one of the precipitating factors in the decision I made that I set a goal to go to law school. And so
he said he wouldn't do it again. What about you?
Well, the practice of law has truly changed.
Yes or no?
I have raised 5 children, and each of them have followed their mothers.
Is this the courtroom or is this the courtroom of public opinion? Yes or no? Mr. Bailey didn't have a problem saying he wouldn't do it again.
I have mixed emotions. I haven't made up my mind, but I will say this, that my children have seen the sacrifices that I've had to make along the way to bring justice on behalf of clients. And it's not, if you think this is a 5-day, 9-to-5 job, you're sadly mistaken.
All right, some words of inspiration from Alan L. Morton, attorney at law. We appreciate that, sir.
You're very welcome.
All right, you're listening to Kevin Miller, 580 KIDO.
Sean Hannity, weekdays at 3. Now, back to Kevin Miller on 580 KIDO, Idaho's first radio station.
Men, 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 manly men, 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 manly men, men, men,
men, men, men, manly men.
And 580 KIDO, Kevin Miller in the morning. It is the Manly Man segment here. Dave Burnett is with us. Dave, good to have you with us.
Good morning, Kevin.
And how was your holiday?
It was busy. I mean, you know, did a lot of work here at the radio station, but all in all, it was good. Thanksgiving Day, fairly quiet, so that's always good.
Yeah, fairly quiet indeed around the Treasure Valley, of course, in other parts of the country. A lot of severe weather, and of course, you had the mainstream media not trying to, you know, trying to figure out what to do as far as the Ferguson story, but as you're always asking me to do, both on and off the air, I'll I'll tell you a little bit about what I did over the holiday.
Mm-hmm. What was it?
And I had a chance to go back to New Hampshire and surprise my parents along with Mrs. Miller. We went to New Hampshire, flew out very, very early, traveled all day, planes, trains, and automobiles. And hopefully I can recall a lot of it for a soon-to-be award-winning blog that details just the just some of the adventures. I didn't meet, but I saw a blue-haired lesbian wearing fedora. I saw people from Nova Scotia that were African Canadians. I had fun running around without power. Did a lot of, I guess, shopping with a state with no income tax. And, that's right, had a great time with my family.
That's good. I mean, just the trip alone. I mean, okay, from Boise, which you have to go somewhere to get somewhere out of Boise.
Sure.
To New Hampshire, which right. I can't imagine there's a whole lot of direct flights into New Hampshire. Where all did you have to go for that?
Well, we went from the nonstop flight from here to Chicago, I think, is one of the best connecting services that you can get. So, you know, from here to Chicago, and then you're always wondering if you're going to make it and everything else. And so you go to Chicago, and then you know, it's funny because, you know, one of our folks here, Alan L. Morton, attorney at law, goes, do they even have an airport in New Hampshire? And they have quite a big one. You know, it's just 40 miles north of Boston. So you fly into Manchester. And,
Manchester the biggest city in New Hampshire?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. You know, and it's all relative. I mean, it's very different. You know, New Hampshire is like Idaho, like reverse the other way, but just smaller.
Reverse, desert, not high desert.
Well, no, but if you take a look at the map, how it's made up, if you flipped Idaho the other way and shrunk it, that would be New Hampshire.
The big fat parts up north.
Yeah, just the way you, New Hampshire has a panhandle, it's just the other side.
Okay.
So it's, so you do that and you go there and, you know, you try and get acclimated, and then the place you're staying at, the hotel, loses power. And, you know, you get to learn about the intricacies of power, and you watch the news being covered there, and you listen to radio. It was interesting. It was nice to show my parents that I hadn't lost it, because they had no idea we were coming. I called my mom right before we knocked on the door, and my wife had never seen that part of the country. So mm-hmm. it was good. It was good to, you know, just kind of decompress, and yet here you have I don't even want to say crazies, but you have the folks in the media riling up the Ferguson situation. I'm going, can't we just enjoy Thanksgiving?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, there's a lot of perspectives to take on this. I found the comments from the boy who was killed, I think it was his cousin or his uncle was in Los Angeles that night. And, you know, he obviously was upset because, you know, he felt the decision should have gone the other way. But the comment he made, which I thought was very insightful, he said the media is to blame for a lot of this. Just from the beginning that they labeled it as a black teen and a white cop. Instead of just saying a teenager and a cop, it instantly, and this is from a black man, he said it instantly drew lines in the sand by labeling people that way. And I thought that was very insightful that it did, that, you know, instantly you're put in a group. If you're black, you're put on his side. If you're white, you're put on the cop side. By the media labeling it that way, rather than just saying that a teenager was, you know, killed by a cop, they had to, you know, label it. And I thought that was very insightful when he said that.
Well, the Boston Globe has always had a strategy that if there is a racial incident, and if it's African-American or a black person attacking a white person, they won't mention the race. But if it's the other way around, that they do that. And you do see that in parts of the country. And back to Mr. Brown's uncle's words, well, that's exactly what happened. They tear it down. They like tearing it down. I didn't know America was such a bad place until I had a chance to watch all the coverage. And I'm going, here we are on Thanksgiving. And, you know, does Anderson Cooper really get a joy out of doing these stories here? I mean, do we really get a joy out of ripping apart the country, how bad it is? What was it? The blue line versus black people and all these other goofy headlines. And I'm going, when is the madness going to stop?
I don't know. You know, it's just too bad that, you know, that everyone's put into a box. I mean, this was a tragic situation. It was tragic for the Brown family. It was tragic for the officer involved, the Wilson family. It's tragic for the community. It's just a, you know, a bad situation, something that happened. The grand jury looked at the evidence, said, nope, there's not enough there. And then suddenly everybody's an expert, even those who haven't seen in the evidence are experts to say one way or the other which way it, you know, which way it was.
Well, but on the other hand, and, you know, this is where the Manly Man segment gets its award-winning things, I disagree. I don't think it was a I think it was a tragic statement, but it could have been avoided if Mr. Brown would do what everybody else had done and just obey the police officer.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's, you know, that's the bottom line. I always tried to train my kids growing up. If you point something at a cop or if you run from the cops, bad things will happen.
And you saw the poor tragedy in Cleveland where you had a kid, I guess, with a toy gun.
It was a paintball, or not paintball, but an airsoft gun.
Yeah.
Which look real, by the
right.
way.
Right. And what are you going to do? And I, you know, I go back to, and I don't know why Officer Wilson decided to go on and get his side of the story. And I guess he felt compelled to do that. But there are threats against his life. You have the New York Times revealing his phone number. And to back to your point, it's not just the media, but the president and his attorney general bear a lot of responsibility in this case.
Yeah. That night, and I found it interesting that that night that, you know, as the president was speaking, that the split screen of the writing was going on. We need to keep calm. And the writing is going on right in the screen next to him. I felt the president did a good job. And then I felt the president didn't shut up because he could have stopped, you know, called for calm, called for rational.
But the president started it.
But then true. But even in his comments the other night, it's like, okay, now stop now. You've done good.
Right. But the president, let's not forget, it was the president and the attorney general that stirred this up.
Yes.
And they did stir it up in Florida, as detailed by our friend Alex Jones. He said, look, you can read the papers where you have, and we reported it, the activists from the Department of Justice urging these people to hit the streets. So to your point, and you're right, that's nice that the president did it, but isn't he talking out of both sides of his mouth?
Well, he wound up that night because he didn't stop. Then he went on to say, you know, people are upset and that's understandable. And no, it's not understandable. You know, it was at that point then he began to condone anything. You know, whatever you're going to do, you're going to do. You know, and it was like, no, stop where you were. Stop right there. That would have been good. Stop right there. But he went on even that night to, you know, basically say, I totally understand why you're mad. You know, I'm on your side. And it's, boy. And now, you know, you're going to have the federal government is investigating it. You know, when, I guess.
But you can't trust the investigation when you have the attorney general. I mean, how hypocritical is it that they're burning stores, and that equates to racial justice, how that they're burning stores and Holder's down there saying he's going to investigate the cops. And then from what I understand, back to your point at 580KIDO, that they're talking about doing something where to undermine the credibility of cops even more. So now the police won't even go into these neighborhoods because heaven forbid something might happen. That just broke over the weekend too, I guess.
Well, yeah, even you, as the riots took place, you saw that the police were kind of handcuffed into what they could do, because if they went in and used too much force, then they were being bullies. You know, I find it fascinating as different members of the black community have spoken out, you know, those who, like Pharrell, the guy with the goofy popcorn hat that has the songs, he said, why aren't we talking about the bullying of Michael Brown? To that convenience clerk and what happened there. He instantly was nailed by the black community for, you know, for being, what are you doing on their side? And, you know, so lines have been drawn. And, you know, I guess in my feeling, you know, is everything perfect as far as race relations in America? No.
See, I think it is.
They're not perfect.
Well, but I do think that it is. I think that this is just ginned up by the media, and I can prove it to you. I can prove it to you.
You know, prove it to me.
I was at a place, and I was commenting on this with Mrs. Miller, and it was something that touched my heart deeply. I saw a young mother with a white kid and a black kid, both calling her mommy, both dressed up as their favorite sports team. Not a ounce of prejudice or race in the body of that woman or those two beautiful little kids. That is the vision of America that goes on each and every day. Now, are there some bad people? Yeah. But come on. Where's the good stories about people that adopt kids of other races and show them unconditional love? I mean, dude, and I'm not getting too coosy-coosy here, I'm almost crying looking at the beauty of that from the other day.
Yeah, but in my opinion, is it perfect? No, but we are far strides from where this country was. And I think the lines of communication have been open. I don't know now, right now, I think on both sides, you're afraid to say anything because you're going to be labeled either way on either side. And it's just been stirred up. But, you know, are things perfect? No, they're not perfect. Are they better than they were? Yes, I believe they are. I mean, I think most people know I have a grandson who's half black. Has he had the N-bomb dropped on him in Idaho? Absolutely he has. But he's been taught, let it roll off your back like water off a duck's back.
See, I don't get where that comes from. Is it hate? Is it stupid? I mean, is it ignorance? Why would anybody, you know what I'm saying? I don't get that.
I don't know. I can't answer that question.
Let me throw this in real quick. We had an incident where Mrs. Miller said she was from Idaho, and all of a sudden a group of black people thought she was a racist.
Oh, sure.
No, and I'm going, Well, see, you're not in Idaho anymore. Very different story in the outside world.
Yeah, it is very different.
I mean, she couldn't believe it. She thought that she goes, well, I'm not from Hayden Lake and all this. I'm like, dude, it doesn't matter.
And the truth is Hayden Lake, it was a handful of people up there. It wasn't the whole town. It was a handful of people that started the church up there.
No, it's just like the John Rocker thing in Survivor. Yeah. They don't know. They just heard, oh, those people are bad.
Yeah, and the media spreads a lot of it. I got to do this. Traffic now as you're coming at it.